The notion of circuits, circuit models for computation, and we'll talk about quantum circuits in particular. To describe quantum circuits, it's going to be important that we talk a little bit about reversible computation. So quantum circuits will have to be reversible, and to get into that, we'll talk a little bit about, first about classical reversible computation, and also throughout the lecture, we'll talk about this notion of computational universality and having a model that you know, can, in principle, compute anything, although not necessarily efficiently. Okay. So, you know, what we would like to do is understand, you know, we're going to try to see some quantum algorithms that can solve some problems faster than classical algorithms can. And to have a model of computation where we can make statements like that and understand what we mean by, you know, certain computations being easy or being hard, we need to have a model that you know, mathematically describes what we mean by efficient computation, and we have to be able to quantify how hard it is to do a certain computation. So there are different kinds of mathematical models of computation that we might use. So for example, the standard model that's usually used for in classical computation is what's called the Turing machine. So you may have heard of this notion of a Turing machine, which is some kind of, you know, from an outsider's perspective, it might seem a little bit esoteric. There's this model of an infinitely long tape and this finite state machine that can write symbols to the tape and, you know, make decisions about what to do based on what's on the tape, and so on and so forth. And so what we're going to do is not to consider a model like that, this model of Turing machines, because it turns out to be a little bit awkward to work with, especially in the context of quantum computing. So, you know, it's possible to define a model of quantum Turing machines, but you really don't want to have to deal with them. It's really a pain. So what turns out to be a better model instead is this model of quantum circuits, which is a quantum analog of classical models of circuits. So this is a way of describing the way a computer works on the basis of how some elementary logic gates would act on some data, be it classical data or quantum data. And so we're going to talk about this model. And now, when you have a model of circuits, if your circuits are built out of elementary gates that are simple, then there's a natural way to quantify how hard a computation is, which is just to just count the number of gates that you have to use in order to do a computation. So, so when we express things in terms of circuits, we can just count the gates and say, you know, that gives us some measure of how hard it is to compute something. But now, in order for this model to be reasonable, you know, we want to make sure that we don't have some restriction on our set of gates that keeps us from computing certain things. So we want to have a universal model of computation where, at least in principle, you could express any function as some circuit over your given gate set. So let's first just kind of review what sort of gates you might take in the context of a classical model. So for a classical circuit model, we'll have some gates which act on a string of bits. So we'll have you know, bits that can store classical data, and those bits will be modified in the course of the computation by some logic gates, and then what we will do is we'll fix some set of simple logic gates, and those logic gates will just act on a few bits at a time. And as I said, we'll count the total number of gates if we want to be able to say what the complexity of some algorithm is. So consider a set of logic gates acting on bits, where, you know, we can consider action on bits instead of trits or some higher dimensional thing without loss of generality. So for example, one set of gates that you might consider would be the following. And if you've seen anything about circuits, you've probably seen this set of gates. So we could have an AND gate. So these, you know, these symbols that I draw are maybe not so important because we won't really be using them later on, but these are the symbols that are normally used for these gates. So I'm just going to write them here. So there's the AND gate, which will compute the logical AND of the two input bits. So if both of the input bits are 1, then the output is a 1, and otherwise the output is a 0. And then we could have an OR gate. So that's a gate that computes the logical OR. And then we could have a logical NOT gate. So that is sometimes drawn like this. So NOT X, sometimes just written X with a bar over it. And so there's one other gate that you would need to include to have a universal set of gates that sometimes you wouldn't even necessarily think about as a gate, but it'll be important to think about the necessity to have such a gate when we think about quantum models, and that's what's called the fan-out gate. So that's just a gate that copies its input. So you could draw that maybe like this. and it's called fanout. So this is just a gate that takes as input a bit x, and it gives as output two copies of that bit. So we talked last time about how, you know, in the context of quantum information, we can't copy quantum states. So in some sense, there's not an analog of this that you could even, you know, well, the analog of this that just takes a quantum state psi and gives you two copies of that quantum state psi, that's not a thing that you could ever hope to realize. I mean, it just violates quantum mechanics to have such an operation. So, you know, we'll have to think about what happens when we try to make, you know, something like a quantum fanout gate. Okay? So this set of gates is universal, which just means that it can compute any function, right? So this set is universal. And what I mean by that is that it can compute any function from n bits to m bits. So any function that I might like to write down that maps some number of bits to some other number of bits, I can find some way to realize it using this gate set. Okay, so I'm not going to prove that, but that's sort of a, you know, basic fact about Boolean logic. Okay, now there's nothing really sacred about this particular choice of gates. There are other sets of gates that you could take that would also be universal. So here's another example of a smaller gate set that's still universal. You know, one thing that you could see if you know, even just a little bit about Boolean logic is that you could get rid of, let's say, the OR gate, right? Because there's something called De Morgan's laws that allow you to express the OR gate in terms of the AND gate and the NOT gate. So if you appropriately negate either the inputs or the outputs, you know, in the right sort of way, then you can write this gate in terms of this gate and some negations. And similarly, you could get rid of the AND gate and keep the OR gate and the NOT gate. But in fact, you can even do a little bit better than that. So you can get down to just two gates. So the NAND gate, which is the gate that takes two bits as input and then outputs the negation of the AND of the two inputs, and fanout. So if I take this together with fanout, then I also get a universal set of gates in the sense that I can compute any function. And now if I wanted to say, you know, how hard it is to compute some particular thing, like, you know, tell whether some number is prime or factor some number or perform some other kind of calculation, I could, in principle, find a way to express that in terms of circuits that use these gate sets. And then I could count the number of gates in the elementary gate set, and that would be a measure of how hard it is to compute something. Now, I would probably get a different specific number for the count if I took this gate set or if I took this gate set. You know, for the smallest circuit for computing something, but the number wouldn't differ by that much. There's only some constant overhead in converting between these two gate sets because you could express each of these gates using some constant number of these gates and vice versa. And so there'll only be some constant overhead when you go between one universal set and the other. And that's you know, a general fact about any universal set of gates. So it doesn't actually matter so much which particular gate set we pick. You know, we just pick one and we work with it. Now, it's, you know, when we reason about algorithms, we might not want to do everything in terms of gates, but you know, and we might use some higher level kind of abstractions. But at least in terms of defining a model, we can use these. And when we talk about quantum algorithms, we really will mostly talk about explicitly about quantum circuits because the kinds of things that we'll be doing will be simple enough that we can really just express everything directly in terms of circuits. Okay. Any questions so far? Good. So now, what we would like to do is we would like to define a quantum analog of this. We'd like to define a quantum circuit model. But the first kind of problem that we encounter in trying to do that, you know, we might like to say, you know, let's just take these classical gates. We put kets around everything. We say this is what they do in the computational basis, and we just say that that's quantum. Sorry, there's a question. Right, so the statement is that this is a universal set. So in particular, you can realize an OR gate somehow using just the ability to compute NAND and fanout. Right? So, I mean, that's a good exercise, actually, to show that this is, you know, take for granted that this gate set is universal and use that fact to show that this gate set is universal. So there's some way of doing it. I mean, I can give you a hint, actually, as to, you know, how you do it. I mean, the first thing to see is how would you perform, say, a NOT gate using this? right? Maybe think about how you would perform a NOT gate using this. And you know, once you do that, you're kind of almost there because you have to just use this fact. I mean, if you can do a NOT gate, then clearly you can do an AND gate, and then this thing I said about De Morgan laws will allow you to do an OR gate. Good. So if we wanted to find a quantum model, you know, the kind of most naive thing you might do would be say, well, let's just turn these things all into unitary matrices and do that. But that actually doesn't work because these operations are not reversible, right? So a quantum model of computation that acts on pure quantum states will involve reversible transformations because it'll involve unitary transformations, which are always invertible linear transformations. And you know, that's just kind of a fundamental principle of quantum mechanics that the dynamics are you know, are reversible. So that's if we want to work within at least within the quantum mechanics of pure states, that's something we can't get away from. We just have to have a model that uses reversible operations. And so kind of the first thing we have to understand is how can we take this model and make it reversible? And it's clearly not reversible. And let's kind of see why not. So. So if we consider, for example, an AND gate, there's no way, in general, to infer the input from just looking at the output. So we can't infer the pair XY from X AND Y. Right? If we just know that the AND of two bits is, if we know that the AND of two bits is 1, then we know what the input is, right? Because we know then both of the input bits had to be 1. But if all we know is that the value of the AND is 0, then you know there are 3 possibilities for the 2 input bits, and there's no way to figure out what they were. So there's no way to run this gate backwards. If you think about this as a space-time diagram in which time is running from the left to the right, if you're here, there's no way to figure out where you came from. Okay, so we have to somehow make this make things reversible. And there's a kind of a general strategy for doing that. So to make a reversible model, the strategy is just to keep the input around. Right? So if we just always kept the input around in some kind of reversible way, then we could always infer the input from the output because we would have the input still sitting there. Right? So let's see how we would do this in the case of an AND gate. The way we would do that is, well, one way of doing that in a way that's kind of commonly used is what's called the Toffoli gate. We're going to use a reversible gate that's called the Toffoli gate. So when we have reversible transformations, they're always going to map the same number of input bits to the same number of output bits. If you want to have a reversible transformation, you have to have that property. And so the Toffoli gate will be drawn as follows. So now our circuits will always just have some horizontal lines representing, for now, bits. So we're just talking about classical computation, but we'll make things quantum later. But we have these lines representing bits where you can think about the information as flowing from left to right. And then we can draw some circuit elements that act on the bits in some way. So this is the symbol that's normally used for a Toffoli gate. And it has the following behavior. So what it does is it reversibly computes the AND of the, you should think of these two bits as the input bits. This bit is the output bit, but there has to be some value for that output bit initially because we have to have something there. Right? So what we're going to do is we're just going to keep the input around. So X and Y will still be there after things go through the gate. And now down here, we would like to have the AND of X and Y. Right? That's what we would like to come out. But we can't do that, for any assignment of this initial bit z, because we have to somehow be able to recover the initial value of z as well. So a simple thing you can do is just take this and XOR it with z, right? So what I mean by this is just bitwise addition mod 2, or in other words, the logical exclusive OR. Okay. So now this gate has the property that if z is initially 0, then what you compute here is just the AND of the two input bits x and y, and if z is equal to 1, then what you get is the negation of that. And this is done in such a way that the gate is reversible. And actually, one very explicit way to see that this gate is reversible is just to figure out what its inverse is. So can somebody tell me what the inverse of this gate is? What operation should I do in order to get the identity, in order to get back the input? Itself, exactly right. So this gate actually is its own inverse. So if I just do the same thing again, then I'll get back the input. Because I'll just XOR the AND in here. And so if I XOR the same thing in twice, then I just, that's like just not doing anything. So you can, one way to think about this picture when you look at it, this is sometimes called a controlled NOT gate. And so what it does is if both of these bits are ones, then it negates this bit, and otherwise it doesn't do anything. So it's a sometimes called a controlled NOT. Okay, so that's one example of a reversible gate, and you can think of it as a way that you would take an AND gate and make it reversible. But now it turns out that actually, if you want to make a universal set of reversible gates, this gate alone is enough to have a reversible gate set. So this gate alone is sufficient for universality, meaning that if you want to compute any function, there's some way of doing it using using this gate. Now, in general, when you perform these computations, you may need to have some extra bits that aren't involved in the input or the output of the function f, which are what are sometimes called ancillas. So we may need what's sometimes called ancillas or workspace. Right? So for example, one thing you could see is, so those workspace bits, you would set them to some fixed values initially, and that would allow you to do the computation that you want. So for example, one thing we would have to do if this is to be a universal set of gates, is we should be able to compute a NOT gate, right? So how can we compute a NOT gate using this Toffoli gate? Exactly, right. So if we want to do NOT, what we should do is we just set x equals y equals 1, and that will allow us to compute NOT. So that's good. So we can do a reversible AND. And we can do a reversible, the NOT gate is itself reversible, right? So if we just said x equals y equals 1, then this thing will just compute a NOT gate. And the only other thing we have to be able to do to have a reversible model of computation is this fan-out gate, right? Now, I was saying before that we couldn't have, in some sense, a fully quantum fan-out gate because, we're not talking about a quantum model yet anyway, right? So we haven't made things quantum. So let's just think about the classical case. So we just want to be able to copy classical bits in order to declare this a universal model. So to do that, we have to again, come up with a simulation. How would we perform a fan-out gate using this gate? Or we could do it using potentially some constant number of invocations of this gate, possibly with even more ancillas. But it turns out that you can do it just using this gate once. So just like with the NOT gate, we can set the initial values of some of the bits to some fixed things and get a NOT gate. There's also some way to do something like that and get a fan-out gate. Can you see how you do that? So what should I set some of the bits to? Yeah, exactly. Right. So if I set y equals 1 and z equals 0, then what happens is it's sort of like this bit isn't there. I mean, this thing is set to 1, so this control is always on. You can think about this dot as a control. It's controlling whether this gate is being applied. And if I set z equals 0, then it's like, this part just isn't there because I'm XORing the thing with 0. So so if I do this, then what I'm effectively doing is like this. The middle bit you can think of as just really not being there. And then this bit is a 0. And so I have this kind of reversible copying, right? So this is an operation where if this bit is a 0, then what I get out are two copies of x. But of course, this thing is defined in a reversible way. So if I take an output for which these two bits are not the same, I have to be able to invert that somehow. And what's going to happen in that case is that this bit won't be 0. When I run the thing backward, I'll get a 1 here instead. Right? So this is now a kind of a reversible copying operation that's defined for any inputs, any two inputs mapped to some outputs, and the whole thing is defined in a reversible way. Okay? Good. So this thing, if I don't consider having to set this bit to 0, this thing is this gate that I've drawn here is another gate that we'll see later on, which is an important gate. This is called the controlled NOT gate. And it's just like the kind of equivalent of the Toffoli gate where I only have one control. So here I have x and y, and the output is x and the XOR of x and y. Okay, so I mention this now just because this is a particular gate that we'll probably see again later on. Okay, but since we've seen how to do we've seen how to do an AND gate and a NOT gate, so that means in particular we can do a NAND gate and also fan out. Then if you believe me that NAND and fan out are universal, then what we've done now is we've constructed a universal model of computation using only reversible gates. And in fact, we only needed one reversible gate. We only needed this Toffoli gate. So this describes some way of performing computations on on classical bits that's fundamentally reversible. Right? And this is something that we, maybe I should have mentioned, this is something that we need to have for a quantum model of computation, but even in the context of classical models, it's something that maybe would be desirable. All the microscopic laws of physics are fundamentally reversible, and so in principle, we should be able to define a reversible model of computation, if we think that really computation is a physical process, which of course it is. So this is actually, this kind of theory of reversible computation is something that was built up and studied even before people were thinking seriously about quantum computing. And you could even try to realize reversible computing devices that would, have certain advantages in that they would dissipate less energy and things like that. But there are also disadvantages of those kinds of systems, which is the reason that it's not really done in practice so much. Our computers actually do get hot because they can run faster that way. Okay. So this is reversible computation. And now what we would like to do is we would like to, I guess there's one other thing that I want to talk about before we go and make this quantum, which is about the uncomputation of intermediate results. What we could do is we could take any computation that we know how to do in an irreversible way, and we could come up with a reversible circuit for it by just, every time we see an AND gate, let's say we're using NAND and fan-out, right? So every time we see a NAND gate, we just implement it in a reversible way using Toffoli gates. Every time we see a fan-out, we implement it in a reversible way, like this, again using a Toffoli gate. And so we can build up our entire circuit in that way so that we get some reversible computation of an arbitrary function. So what will that look like when we write down a circuit for such a thing? So any function be computed reversibly. And so the circuit will look like this. So we'll have a bunch of input bits. So let's say we have n input bits. And we can represent them like this. And then we'll have to have a place where we write the output. So say we have m output bits. So we can initialize those output bits to 0. And then what we would like is that at the end of the day, the output is written there. And then we may also need to have some other bits around, maybe a large number of bits around, that we use for intermediate computations, right? If we compose these gates together in some circuit, we may need to compute some bits that aren't involved in the final answer, but are just intermediate things that we compute along the way. And so we'll have a bunch of other bits that maybe initially are all zeros that allow us to store these intermediate results. Okay. So now what we can do is we can come up with a reversible circuit, which is just composed out of Toffoli gates. So you might need to have some input bits which are ones. So maybe you could imagine that this circuit consists of both NOT gates and Toffoli gates. But this could be a circuit consisting only of reversible gates that would then compute some arbitrary function. And what it will do with the output is, first of all, it will keep the input around, because that's the way that our simulations always worked. We never got rid of the input. We always kept it there. So here we have x1 through xn. And then what you'll have for these bits will be the function that you want to compute evaluated on the input, x1 through xn. So let's call those bits y1 through ym. But then you may also have a bunch of other bits in some arbitrary values, which were the results of all the intermediate computations you did along the way. So let's call those J1 through JK. And so this is the input, this is the output, and this is what you might call junk. It's stuff that you needed in order to get to the final answer, but it's not stuff that you need at the end of the day because it's not part of the final answer. So in general, if we perform this kind of simulation, we'll have some junk left over. And something that we might like to do would be to get rid of that junk. There are different reasons for wanting to do that. One might be that this could be a large number of bits, and if we're actually trying to do some reversible computation, we might need that space for some further computation that we do along the line. And so we might need to reset those bits back to zero so we could use them again as ancilla bits for some later part of the computation. And actually, later on, when we talk about quantum models of computation, it'll really be important that we can reset them back to zero, because if we didn't reset them to zero, they could inhibit quantum interference that would lead to computational speedup, right? So quantum algorithms will all be about getting different computational paths to interfere in a good way. And if you had information stored in this junk beyond what you want to have in the output, then that could prevent the interference that you would like to have. And so for the quantum case, it'll really be essential not just to save space, but even just to make the algorithm work, to make some algorithms work, to be able to reset those bits back to zero. So so now let's see how we can do that. So there's kind of a simple trick for doing that, and it's good to know that you can do this. Okay, so. So to reset the workspace, what we can do is basically perform the circuit, copy the output that we want into some other registers where we'll store the output, and then perform the circuit in reverse in order to uncompute all of this intermediate junk. So what that will look like is the following. So we have our input bits x1 through xn, and then we have our initial zeros that will be used to store the output of that circuit. And we'll have a bunch of zeros for the workspace, the things that store the intermediate results. And now we're going to add another block of bits, which are also initially zeros, where we're going to really store the final answer in this reversible computation where we have no junk. And now what we'll do is we'll apply this circuit C to compute the function in that sense, where we have some values now for these junk bits. But now what we can do after we've computed the function in this sense is that we can reversibly copy the output down to these bits. So here we have, here we have m bits, and here we also have m bits. And so we can do that by just performing these controlled NOT gates, right? Just like we did here. We can do a CNOT from this bit to this bit, and from the second bit here to the second bit here, et cetera, down through the last bit with the last bit. Okay, so we do this. And now we've got the answer written in two places, right? We've got the answer written here, and we also have the answer written here. But we still have these junk bits lying around. So now what we can do is just perform the circuit in reverse. And this is a reversible circuit because it was made up out of reversible gates. So that means that it has some inverse, and we can do its inverse just by taking each of the gates in this circuit and doing them in the reverse order, doing their inverses. If we use just gates like Toffoli and Knott that are their own inverses, then in fact all we do is reverse the circuit, right? Okay, so here's the inverse of the circuit. And now what we have here is, these bits will still be x1 through xn, but these bits will have been reset back to zero. And these bits will also have been reset back to zero. So now all of our junk bits have been returned to zero. And what we have over here is the answer. So this is y1 through ym. So now we've uncomputed the junk bits. And this idea of uncomputing things is something that you often need to worry about in quantum models, as I was saying. So what you can see by this kind of construction, first of all, there's not too much overhead, right? You have twice as many gates as you had in the original circuit, plus you need to have, you know, m gates in order to do this reversible copying. But that's not too much overhead. It's like, some constant factor, right? Because there's this factor of 2, and then you also have to add m. But, you know, in order to write something to all these m bits, you had to have the number of gates in this circuit be at least something like m. So this is really just some constant factor overhead in going from the original reversible circuit to this reversible circuit. So that's really not so bad in terms of the additional complexity. And the benefit that you have is now you've reset all of your junk bits. Okay, so what this says is that in general, you can take some function that you know how to compute reversibly. So in general, we can compute a map that goes like from x and let me just write z to x and z plus f of x. Now we may need to do this in the presence of some ancillas, so there may be some zeros lying around. It's going to be necessary that we have these initial zero ancillas in order to do something like this. But we'll be able to perform this kind of map in an efficient way. So if we can perform f efficiently. So if there's a classical, not necessarily reversible circuit for f that computes it efficiently, just if you know that there's an efficient classical algorithm for computing f, then there's an efficient way of performing this transformation, which is now reversible. So here when I write XOR, this z could be a string of many bits, because the output could be a string of many bits. So what I mean here is just the bitwise XOR, just XOR the bits bitwise. OK, so this is going to be a useful thing to do. So for example, in Shor's algorithm, we'll have to do something like this, where we compute some function in a reversible way, and where we don't have any junk lying around. Yes?
When you use the word efficiently here, do you mean something specific?
Yeah, I do mean something specific. And we're going to talk, I'm going to make this more precise later on. But what I mean is that, so informally what I mean is that the number of gates that we need is not too big. And the specific notion that we'll have later on is that it's only polynomially big. So there's an input size, and we'll want the number of gates to be upper bounded by some polynomial in the input size. We'll talk more about this later on. Is there another question?
Yeah. So why don't we need to be able to compute f reversibly if we want to do this stuff?
Why do we need to be able? Oh, why don't we? Well, because if we can compute f at all, even with a not necessarily reversible circuit, there's a way of making that circuit reversible. There's a kind of mechanical procedure you can go through that does that, where you just express the original computation in terms of the irreversible gates. You simulate those using reversible gates. So you take the AND gates and you use.
Okay, so we can just translate.
You just translate. Yeah, that's all I'm saying. Yeah, you just translate, and then you can do this trick so that there's no junk. Yeah, that's it. OK, good. So this is something that you can do in a, in a classical reversible model of computation. But now what we're going to do is we're going to take this whole thing and we're going to make it quantum. So similarly, you could imagine all of these things as quantum circuits, right? So this is some picture of a classical reversible circuit where we have input bits and output bits. But you could imagine that these zeros and ones are encoded in quantum states. And you basically just put a ket around everything. And now we've defined some unitary transformation on a Hilbert space of qubits. So if we just define this operation, and we can think about quantum circuit elements like, for example, the CNOT gate or the Toffoli gate that could act on quantum data, then we could think about this whole thing as defining a unitary transformation. And so this unitary transformation is defined by how it acts on basis states, but it's defined on all states but just by linearity, right? Because quantum mechanics is linear. So if we take a linear combination of input states, then the output could be some would be the corresponding linear combination. So what we can see immediately is that we can do the same thing quantumly. And the statement is just that if we have some input state, which is a computational basis state, x, z, 0, then we can map that to the state x, z plus f of x, 0. And, you know, correspondingly, like, linear combinations of the basis states are mapped just according to linearity. So I didn't do anything. I just put kets around everything. And now we have, you know, a model of quantum computation. But we don't yet have one where we can do, you know, arbitrary quantum operations. Because if we just take these reversible operations and think about them as acting on quantum states, you know, if we have a computational basis state input, we'll only have a computational basis state output. We'll never have any superposition. So in order to have an interesting model of quantum computation, we need to add more gates. We need to have some gates that allow us to have superpositions of basis states so we can actually have interference going on and we can actually have some quantum effects. So that's the next thing we're going to talk about, and this notion of universality for quantum circuits. Any questions before I get into that? Okay, so what do we mean by universality for quantum circuits? So for classical circuits, what we meant was that in principle, we could compute any function. So any function we might want to compute, we could realize it by some sequence of logic gates. If we want to do something like that quantum mechanically, the kind of analogous notion would be that we could realize any transformation that we could in principle do to a quantum state. So that would be any unitary transformation, right? We would like to perform any unitary transformation on our n qubits, on our 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space. So this is what we would mean. The ability to do any unitary transformation in, let's say, U 2 to the n, so the group of 2 to the n by 2 to the n unitary matrices. So that may sound like a tall order because that's a lot more transformations than just the reversible classical transformations on this state space, right? So if we have the space of corresponding to n-bit strings, that's this 2 to the n dimensional space, and the classical reversible transformations on that space are just the permutations. So there are a lot of those, certainly. But there are a lot more unitary transformations, right? There's infinitely many. There's even uncountably many because this is an infinite group, and so there's really just a lot of transformations that you might have to realize. But still, we can think about a notion of quantum circuits that are universal for this, in this quite strong sense that we can really realize exactly any unitary from the unitary group corresponding to n qubits, and here's one universal set of gates. So we're not going to show this, but if you'd like to read more about this, there's a really nice treatment in Nielsen and Chuang. Sorry, is that a question first?
Yeah, sorry. If you have an infinite set of input states, then you could do any permutation. Would you expect there to be some kind of isomorphism between the possible permutations and the unitary transformations in that case?
I guess I'm not sure exactly what you're saying. So you mean in the classical setting you have permutations of bits, and then you want to consider like the possibility of having strings of arbitrary length, or
if you allowed yourself, yeah, arbitrary long strings, would there be some kind of mapping between permutations and units?
Well, no, I think there can't be, right? Because if you consider, if you just consider strings which can be of any length, you're going to have some countable set of strings. So the set of transformations on them also is going to be countable. And you know, here the set of unitaries is going to be uncountable.
What if you're allowed like countably many inputs, uncountably many?
So somehow you restrict the set of quantum states that could be inputs to be some countable set of states?
No, sorry, classically. If you had an uncountably many input, classical input state.
Well, I guess I'm just not sure what that would mean. You would have to have some notion of like real valued computation. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how to make up some correspondence. Right, but I'm just not sure what a natural kind of state space to take would be. I don't know. But this issue, I don't want to get too hung up on this issue because we're going to talk about now what we mean in this about this strong notion of universality where you can really do any unitary. But we're very quickly going to change to a different model where we just demand that we approximate the unitaries, and then we will have actually accountable set of circuits that we might do. So. It's probably not a big deal, this kind of issue of like whether you know, in some sense, it's not really physically realistic to try to be able to exactly realize an arbitrary unitary. So nothing that we do in practice is going to care about these questions about whether the thing is, you know, countably infinite or uncountably infinite. I mean, it's going to be important that things are actually just finite, you know, when we think about at least circuits of some fixed size. So I think these maybe more mathematical questions are not going to be so important for you know, kind of practical issues of computation. Yeah. Okay. So, all right. So now what we can do is we can show that you know, if you want to think in this sense where you really have you really demand this very strong and probably unreasonable thing that you want to be able to do a completely arbitrary unitary on n qubits, then you can show that the following set of gates is universal. So it's certainly going to have to be an infinite set, but you know, let's just consider such a thing. So suppose we are able to do C0 gates. So that's a 2-qubit gate that acts on any 2 qubits that we like, and then the set of all single qubit gates. Right, so that's an infinite set of gates that you might do on a single qubit, but it's only gates acting on a single qubit, not acting on any more than one qubit. So this is a universal set. So as I was saying, if you're interested in seeing how you would show this, there's a quite a nice treatment in the book by Nielsen and Chong. So you can see that that this set of gates is universal in this fairly strong sense. But what we would really like is to have a finite set of gates that we can still think of as universal. Because there are various reasons for wanting that. One is that we would like to have some finite specification of algorithms, right? So we don't want it to be the case that to say what an algorithm is, we have to specify the entries of some unitary matrices to arbitrary precision. So that would be kind of unfortunate if we had to do that. Just to have what's called a uniform model of computation, a model of computation where we can describe what the circuits are for inputs of different sizes in a way that can be generated by a simple procedure, we need to have some finite set of gates. And also for fault tolerance, which is something that we'll talk about more later on. So in order to have a model where we can correct against errors that might occur in the computation, it's really important to have a finite set of gates. So for a lot of reasons, we would like to get away from this situation where we have an infinite gate set. So we'd like to have a finite gate set. So how can we do that? So it seems like we're sort of in a bad place because if we demand this strong notion of universality, where we want to exactly realize any unitary transformation, then we're just going to have that's an uncountable set, and so we're going to have some uncountable set of not just infinite, but some uncountable set of transformations available to us that we can use to realize our quantum circuits. So we have to somehow weaken our notion of universality in order to get this. But fortunately, we can weaken it a little bit, and not too much, in such a way that all the computations that we might like to do can be carried out well enough. And then what we'll find is that we actually can have finite sets of gates that are universal. And the way that we do that is to only demand that we approximate our gates. So to get this, we only demand approximate realizations. So now what we'll say is that a set of gates is universal if any unitary transformation on the n qubits that you might want to do can be approximated arbitrarily closely by some sequence of gates from the finite gate set. So maybe I should say that. So we say a set of gates is approximately universal, or universal in an approximate sense. It's not that it's approximately universal. It's not that the universality is approximate. It's that the you're universal in the sense that you can approximate anything that you like. We say a set of gates is universal in an approximate sense if, for any unitary, so any u in the unitary group, acting on two to the n dimensional vectors, and any precision epsilon we like, so any positive number epsilon, there's some circuit. And let me just write V for the unitary operation that's realized by that circuit. So there's a circuit V using gates from the set, so from the universal set. So that the distance between U and V is at most epsilon, where I'm going to have to define what this distance is. Okay, so where D is some distance measure that takes as input, two unitaries. So it's a map from U2 to the n by U2 to the n to the positive real numbers. And it should just be some distance measure. And now you could define any distance measure you like. And that would give you some notion of universality. And the notion of universality could depend on which distance measure you take. But for practical purposes, it won't, because we're not saying anything about how fast this distance has to go to zero as a function of the size of the circuit or anything like that. So basically, any reasonable distance measure will give you the same notion of which sets of gates are approximately universal. Okay. So just to be concrete about this and really instantiate this distance measure, let me give you an example. This is the one that's usually taken when people define this notion of approximation. So we could use the distance between U and V is just the spectral norm of the difference of U and V. So this is the spectral norm. Right, so you just take the eigenvalues of the difference of U and V, you take their absolute values, you sort them, you take the biggest one. So this is another way of thinking about this is that it's the maximum over all quantum states, so really normalized quantum states. So those quantum states are unit vectors in this Hilbert space. It's the maximum over all psi of the norm now on vectors of U psi minus V psi. Right? So in other words, this measure is like how far apart could the output states be when you took the same input state to both of the gates. Right? So you do U on psi or you do V on psi, and you look at how different they could be. And if they're not that different for any state that you might give as input, then you would say that the two gates are close. And this number would be some quantitative way of saying how far apart they are. Right? So now we say a set of gates is universal if for any unitary operation that we might be given acting on the n qubits, we can come up with some circuit that will realize that operation that we'd like to do up to precision epsilon, and we can do that for an epsilon as small as we like. Now, of course, the circuit V will be different in general if I take epsilon to be smaller and smaller, right? So I may have to take a much bigger circuit V if I want to do the circuit to much higher precision, but I can always find such a circuit. So this notion of universality is not about efficiency. It's really just about what are the operations that we can do in principle with a circuit of some size. And we'll worry about efficiency when we talk about specific algorithms. So questions about this notion of approximation or distance? OK, good. So now what we would like is to have a set of gates that's universal in this sense, right? So we would like to somehow get down to just a finite set of gates that we can say is universal in the sense of approximation with, let's say, this distance measure. So let's do that. So the first thing to see is that since C naught plus all 1-qubit gates is universal, it'll suffice to just find some way of approximating single qubit gates from some finite set. So now what I'd like to do is find some finite set of single qubit gates that have the property that if I do some sequence of them, I can use that to approximate arbitrarily closely any single qubit gate that I might like. And you know, if I can do that, then I can in principle approximate arbitrarily closely any gate acting on 2 to the n qubits, acting on n qubits, so on a 2 to the n dimensional state space, because I can just take all of the single qubit gates in the realization of the circuit using using this set, and I just approximate all of those single qubit gates using the gates from my finite set, and then I'll get some approximate realization of the whole thing. And you can work out, you know, how good that approximation is, you know, taking into account how the errors in the single qubit gates turn into errors in the big circuit. So I mean, there's some details to think about there, but at least it's hopefully intuitively plausible that if you approximate all of the single qubit gates really well in terms of this kind of decomposition of the gate, then you'll get some good approximation of the overall thing. Okay, good. So if you want to be able to do this, you know, so first of all, this is nice because now we can just think about that block sphere picture that we were talking about last time, right? So the single qubit gates just correspond to rotations of the block sphere, and now it's just enough to think about how can we use single qubit gates to rotate the block sphere in arbitrary ways, right? So one thing that you can see, and this is maybe somewhat clear from just your geometric intuition about you know how you can rotate a sphere. If you want to be able to perform arbitrary single qubit gates arbitrarily well, it's enough to be able to do rotations about two different axes by irrational multiples of pi. So it suffices to rotate the block sphere about two different axes. They should be, you know, not parallel axes. They should be really distinct axes, but otherwise they could be arbitrary axes. By irrational multiples of pi. And you know, the reason for this irrationality is the following, right? So let's first just think about rotation about one axis. Well, if we have rotation about some axis by a rational multiple of pi, then we're only going to generate some finite set of rotations, right? So if it's a rotation by, say, pi over 2, you know, then there's only like, you know, 4 places that we can rotate to. But if we have a rotation by an angle that's an irrational multiple of pi, then we can approximate anything arbitrarily closely just by some argument kind of based on the pigeonhole principle, right? If we kind of rotate by lots of different amounts, you know, we'll never come back to where we started. And so we have to eventually fill up densely the set of all the possible rotations about that axis. So you can think about how to formalize that, but hopefully the kind of geometric intuition is clear. So that says if you can rotate about one axis by an irrational multiple of pi, you can effectively rotate about that axis by an arbitrary angle, or at least you can approximate things arbitrarily well for the rotation by an arbitrary angle. And now if we can do this about two different axes, then we can really get to anywhere that we like, right? So if you can rotate about two different axes by any angle that you like, then you can in principle perform any rotation. And again, this is just, you know, a statement about rotations in 3 dimensions, so hopefully your geometric intuition helps you. Okay? So now all we have to do is come up with you know, some gates that allow us to rotate about two different axes by angles that are irrational multiples of pi. So I'm not going to prove to you that that a certain set of gates has this property, but I'll tell you one set of gates that works. So here's a set of gates that suffices for this. So these two gates are called H and T. And H is just the Hadamard gate that we saw last time. So this is Hadamard. And this other gate, T is a rotation about the z-axis. So this is the gate 1, 0, 0, e to the I pi over 4. So this is like a, you know, a square root of I. So this is sometimes called the T gate, because people always use the symbol T for it, or sometimes the pi over 8 gate. Why the pi over 8 gate? Well, because you know, if you like, you can write this thing as, you know, e to the I pi over 8, times here e to the minus I pi over 8, e to the plus I pi over 8. So sometimes this is called the pi over 8 gate.
What symbol do we use
for the Toffoli gate? Well, you mean in a circuit diagram?
Like as opposed to T.
I don't know. I guess you should use something other than T, because you usually use T for this. So often in quantum algorithms, you don't have to explicitly use the Toffoli gate because, so what we've just seen is that this set of gates is universal for single qubit gates, and then when we add this to C0, then we can, in principle, do anything. So for example, there's some way of building a Toffoli gate out of HT and C0 gates. And so we usually, sometimes we don't think about the Toffoli gate as an elementary gate. So if we're not writing it down, we don't need to worry about what symbol it is. I guess if we have both T gates and Toffoli gates, then, we just need to decide. I don't know. Sometimes, I don't know if you like multi-letter symbols. Sometimes I just write this if I have to express a Toffoli gate. But I don't know. You just have to come up with something that works, I guess. OK, so as I was saying, this is a universal set as far as single qubit gates are concerned. And now if we put this together with C0, then what we get, so if we take C0, H, and T, this is a universal set for any number of qubits. Again, in this approximate sense. So what that says is that any gate acting on any number of qubits could in principle be realized by some sequence of C0, H, and T gates. Not necessarily exactly, but you could approximate things as closely as you like. And in particular, this does mean that, for example, you can do a Toffoli gate using some sequence of these gates. And you could think about what's the smallest circuit that does that. And that's actually a question that that people think about. And there are questions that are surprisingly hard to answer, like just what's the smallest number of gates from this particular set that will realize a Toffoli gate, or something you might try to do is minimize the number of T gates in a realization of the Toffoli gate. That's something that people want to do just because they're interested in minimizing things in ways that have to do with fault-tolerant computing. And actually, that question of what's the smallest number of T gates, that question was answered like last year. So there are like surprisingly difficult questions about surprisingly simple things, just about these 2x2 and 4x4 and 8x8. Unitary matrices. Okay. But there's something kind of interesting here, which is that we can have a quantum set of universal gates that only involves one and two qubit gates. So we don't have any gate here that acts on more than two qubits. Whereas to have a universal set of reversible classical gates, we need to have a three qubit gate, right? So the Toffoli gate itself is universal. There's no way to have a universal set of reversible gates acting on only two qubits at a time. That's something that you can show. So somehow in the quantum state space, you have more room to move around. And because of that, it suffices to just have these two-qubit operations, and you can be universal. OK, so there are some symbols that we'll use in order to represent circuits using these gates. So we'll draw pictures like that one, where we have horizontal lines representing qubits, where you think of time as moving from right to left. And we'll draw circuits that look like this. So the C0 gate will be drawn just like we drew it before. And then we could have, for example, an H gate or a T gate. So we just draw an H in a box or a T in a box to represent the Hadamard gate or the T gate. And now we can write down quantum algorithms by specifying circuits in this way. And that's what we'll do when we start to talk about quantum algorithms. And there's another common notation that you may see, and we'll actually use this, I guess, when we talk about circuits for the quantum Fourier transform, which is this notion of a controlled unitary gate. Which looks like this. So we could have a control like this, and then a general unitary U. And this is a two-qubit gate, if U is a one-qubit gate, that has the following matrix. So you can think about it as a block matrix, where the upper left block is identity, the off-diagonal blocks are 0, and the lower right block is U. So in other words, if this qubit is initially in the 0 state, then nothing is done down here. The identity is done down here. And if this qubit is initially a 1, corresponding to this lower block, then the unitary U is applied. And we'll also make use of gates like this for U other than not, right? So if U is just the X gate, the not gate, then we then we draw this symbol, but we could have more general gates U, and we'll have occasion to use some things like this when we talk about the quantum Fourier transform. Okay. So I think probably we should wind things up there. There was one other remark that I wanted to make about conversions between different gate sets and something called the Soloveitchi-Taieff theorem, but maybe I'll just hold this over to next time, and we'll talk about that at the start of next lecture, and then we can actually end on time. So are there any last questions just before we go? Okay, great. So see you tomorrow.